In December of 1974, I was 23 years old and a student at the Unitarian Universalist Seminary in Berkeley, Starr King School for the Ministry. I lived about 8 miles north of Berkeley in a town called Richmond because I was able to live there rent-free in exchange for painting the interior walls of the house. I was with a couple other students. There was a man who wanted to sell this house and wanted it fixed up before he put it on the market. And so we were doing the work while living there without any charge. And also because we were living there, it made less likely that it could be vandalized. One afternoon after class, I took the Bay Area Rapid Transit train, the BART line, up to Richmond, and I was walking to the house. It was about a mile from the train stop. About halfway there, I passed a group of young men, and one of the young men stepped out of the group, and he said to me, this is Richmond, and there are no white people allowed in Richmond. And I was, as I said, 23 and a little bit arrogant, I guess. And I said, well, I'm a white person, and I live in Richmond. And I said it in kind of a defiant way, because the next thing I knew, he swung and he hit me in the head. And if you watch movies and television, you see a lot of people getting hit. And for some reason, they get hit over and over and over again, and then they're able to stand up and walk away and have conversations. And it's no big deal. Well, real life isn't like that, I learned. There was pain in the side of my head, but it wasn't so much the pain. It was the jumbling of my vision and my ability to see, actually. I was seeing double suddenly. And I was very disoriented and somewhat shocked by what had happened. I had been raised as a child by my father as a conscience objector, my mother as a former Mennonite, and my minister at the Unitarian Universalist Church, who was a former Quaker, to learn that the divinity of all human beings, and that in every human being, no matter how bad we may think they may be, if you can reach out and speak to them at a human level and touch their soul, then the goodness will come out. There's potential goodness in everyone. And that this had been taught to me as a young person, that in every human being is divine. As we say in our own statement, we respect the dignity of every person. There's potential goodness in everyone. I didn't think of any of that right at that moment. It was just not a thought that came to me at all. I had instead a very selfish thought. And I'd read books about Gandhi and nonviolence. I'd read books about Martin Luther King and Thoreau, civil disobedience. But my thought was that I did not want to get hurt. And there was this one fellow who was bigger than I was, and there were other people in a group nearby. And so I said what came to mind. And I said, I don't want to fight you. And he swung at me again. This time I stepped back and he missed. I stepped back actually into the road. There were cars on the road going by, and I thought, maybe some nice Samaritan will stop and say, here, get in and drive me away, and I would get away from this guy. But no, they swerved as they saw me stepping into the road, and they honked and they went on. Nobody stopped. So I said a second time, I don't want to fight you. And he swung at me again. And then I said a third time, because I had no idea what to do, and this was the only words that came to mind, I don't want to fight you. At that point, after swinging at me three times, hitting me once, he put down his hands, and he said, why not? And again, The thought that came to mind wasn't about the divinity of all of us and the sacredness of all human life and that violent people can be reached and there's potential goodness in everything. None of that occurred to me. What occurred to me was, and what I said was, I don't want to get hurt. Very selfish, but that's what I said. He said, "That's cool." And he put out his hand, and we shook hands, and I walked away, and he walked away. Everyday nonviolence. I recommend I statements, if you can't think of anything else to say, as a way of living your life in a nonviolent way, to make an honest, clear, simple, selfish I statement. My first lesson today in nonviolence, in practical, everyday nonviolence. In my 63 years on Earth, I've learned that even those of us raised by pacifist parents can, in the right circumstances, turn violent. And when we feel threatened, the adrenaline gets going. The part of our brain that deals with emotion tells us to fight, to defend ourselves, to defend our family, to defend our friends, to defend our country. That this is part of who all of us are, even when we're raised not to be violent. So it's not necessarily enough to have a philosophy of an idealist philosophy of human nature, but also to have some practical tools to live a life of nonviolence. The first practical tool that I learned was to make I statements, and that sometimes works. Back in 1919, trying to convince people to support the League of Nations, Woodrow Wilson told a story, and it's a story I think of sometimes when I feel that adrenaline surging into my body and I'm feeling that need to fight and to defend myself and to be violent. Wilson was traveling across the United States on a train trying to convince people to vote, to tell their senators to vote to support the League of Nations. Ultimately, he was not successful, and the League of Nations treaty did not pass in the Senate. But he had a stump speech, and he would tell the same story to group after group after group. And this is the story. There were two men in a village in a small town where they had this reputation for getting into these really loud arguments. And they would, in these arguments, they would start swearing at each other and using the worst kind of insults and profanity as they argued with each other. After listening to this for a while, their friends said, "Listen, we really find your behavior offensive. We don't like it when you two start fighting and you start swearing at each other. We don't like to hear it. We certainly don't want our children to hear it. So here's the deal. Next time you do this, we want you to promise us that you will get on the local tram here in town and take it out to the edge of town where nobody can hear you. And then you can yell at each other all you want, you can use all the profanity you want, and nobody else will hear you. We won't have to listen to what you're saying." So the men agreed to do this. And the next time they got into an argument, they remembered their promise to their friends. They got on the tram and they rode out to the edge of town. It took about 25 minutes or so. And they got out and they were out in the fields and there was nobody around and they looked at each other and they weren't angry anymore. Now Wilson said this is what the League of Nations is for. When two countries get into an argument, rather than stand and fight, it's to get those countries to come to Geneva, to the League of Nations headquarters, and to have a conversation. And that eventually, just the amount of time to travel there and then the amount of time they spent talking about things, they will not actually go to war. And that's why we need the League of Nations. But isn't it a wonderful story for our own lives, for our own experiences? I read in trying to learn about relationships and partnerships and marriages and things like that, I read a book by a man named Gottman who does research in Seattle. And Gottman takes people and puts them in a studio apartment. He started with couples, young couples, husband and wives, and they would be put in this studio apartment outside Seattle in this university laboratory where there were video cameras and there were tape recorders, and they wore portable devices which kept track of their blood pressure and their heart rate. And they only turned those off when they used the restroom or when between 9 at night and 9 in the morning they were able to turn those off and the cameras were turned off. But for 12 hours a day, they were monitored. And Gottman asked these couples, we're trying to learn about relationships. Can you, in the course of the weekend, while you're staying in the studio apartment, we're observing you, can you talk about some contentious issue in your relationship? Just pick whatever it is. Maybe one of you wants to get a cat and the other one doesn't like pets. Maybe one of you wants to buy a new house and the other one doesn't want to. Maybe one of you wants to go on a vacation to Europe and the other one wants to go and visit the in-laws. Whatever the issue is, just pick an issue and have a conversation about it and let us observe you. And what Gottman concluded after observing this is that it takes about 20 minutes for the adrenaline that gets stirred up in our bloodstream when we have an argument, for that to pass away, for our heartbeat to return to normal, for our blood pressure to return to normal. So he said this idea of timeouts in relationships is really healthy and important. When you find yourself in this emotional experience, when you're really angry at your children, or you're angry at your best friend, or you're angry at your congregation, or you're angry, whoever it is, take a break. Let yourself calm down. Walk away for 20 minutes and let your body's chemistry return to normal. Because in that time when you're really angry and the chemistry's going, you're going to say really stupid things or do really stupid things, like put your hand through a wall or throw a dish or something. And you don't want to do that. You want to calm down. The same thing that Woodrow Wilson was talking about in his story. So that's the second lesson I have to offer about practical nonviolence. Take time out. But sometimes we're in a situation where we need to try to remain calm and not become violent, and we can't have that 20 minutes to walk away and come back. We need to do it right now, and we feel ourselves getting out of control. When that happens, I think of a third story. The story is about the Zen Buddhist Vietnamese priest Thich Nhat Hanh. It occurred in 1968, a long time ago now, when he was a young Buddhist. He came to America and went on a tour to churches around the United States to talk about how he would like the United States to withdraw their military from Vietnam and to stop bombing his country. And he would give talks in various auditoriums of churches. He was speaking in St. Louis in 1968. And after he finished his talk, as he would usually do, he took time for questions. And one man stood up and became incredibly hostile and abusive, saying, what right have you as a Vietnamese to come here and tell us as Americans what we can do? If you really care about the suffering of your people, then you should get on a plane and go back to your own country, go to a hospital, go to an orphanage, and help those people who are suffering. You're just a communist pretending to be a Buddhist priest. You are out there to destroy our country. And if we lose Vietnam, then it's going to be the Philippines next, and then it'll be Hawaii, and then they'll be right on our shores. You are an outrageous person. You are destroying our country. On and on and on and on. Go back home to Vietnam. After this tirade, Thich Nhat Hanh responded by saying, if you want a tree to grow, you don't water the leaves, you water the roots. And because the roots of the violence in my country, many of them, are here in the United States, if I want peace to grow, I need to come here and address the roots of the problem rather than address the leaves of the tree to water the roots. And that is why I'm here. And then he said something to the man who was moderating the meeting, and he left the room and he went out a side door. Well, the friend who was with him on the tour followed him out, and he told the story. He's found this Buddhist, Thich Nhat Hanh, almost in a state of panic from that experience of being so viciously attacked in this public meeting and criticized. And he noticed that Thich Nhat Hanh was trying to control his breathing. And finally, after 5 minutes or so, he got to a point where he could talk. His friend said, you know, even a pacifist has the right to get angry sometimes. And if you felt angry towards this man, you should have expressed it. And Thich Nhat Hanh said, well, if it was just me, perhaps. But I'm here representing my entire country, all my people. And I have a responsibility to try to remain calm and civil, even in the event of this kind of criticism and attack. And so I did not feel I had a right to become angry. And he said, well, how did you control yourself? And he says, in meditation, we learn about breathing, to breathe in and to breathe out, to pay attention to where our breathing is. When we're under stress and we're feeling that violence, we start to breathe very shallowly, or not to breathe at all and even hold our breath. But if we can keep breathing, if we can keep focusing on taking that breath in and breathing out and being at peace, then I could control myself and remain calm. And then when I left the room, I did that again to calm myself down. So I have found when I am in a situation where I am feeling a tendency towards violence, when I feel that adrenaline starting to flow because I sense that I'm under attack, that I remember the story of Thich Nhat Hanh and the importance of breathing, to ask myself, where is my breath right now? Where am I breathing? Am I breathing? Am I holding my breath? And to use that to help control my emotions and to remain a person who is not going to commit violence in the situation I'm in, either verbally or physically. Human beings have evolved a tendency to feel angry, to feel violence. And we feel this not only with strangers, but also with the people we love. As I said earlier, Gandhi was married when he was 13. And in his autobiography, he described the first years of his marriage. He wrote, "If I should pledge to be faithful to my wife, she should also pledge to be faithful to me." That thought made me a jealous husband. I had absolutely no reason to suspect my wife's infidelity, but jealousy does not wait for reasons. I was forever on the lookout regarding her movements, and therefore she could not go anywhere without my permission. This sowed the seeds of a bitter quarrel between us. The restraint was virtually a sort of imprisonment. And my wife was not the girl to brook any such thing. She made it a point to go out whenever and wherever she liked. More restraint on my part resulted in more liberty being taken by her, and in my getting more and more cross. Refusal to speak to one another thus became the order of the day with us. My severities were all based on love. I wanted to make my wife an ideal wife. I can hear the voice of many men who have abused their wives in those words. This is Gandhi. My severities were all based on love. I wanted to make my wife an ideal wife. Jealousy. I had absolutely no reason to suspect my wife's infidelity, but jealousy does not wait for reasons. He wrote these words when he was 58 years old, after his marriage at the age of 13. He was deeply ashamed of the way he had treated his wife as a teenager and a young man. And I chose the video from the movie Gandhi and this passage in his autobiography to make a point, to illustrate that the potential for domestic conflict is possible even with the greatest teacher of nonviolence. All of us have this potential, all of us men, to mistreat women. Many years ago, I was serving as a minister in my first church, and after the sermon, one of the members of the congregation came up to me and said, "You can't go into your office right now." And he said, "Let me explain what's going on." One of the women in the congregation arrived at church today with two children, and I noticed bruising on her arms. And so I pulled her aside. We didn't come to the church service, and I've been talking to her. And she finally admitted to me that her husband had been hitting her, and it wasn't the first time. And he says, "And these are not small bruises." So I took her into your office, which is a private space, and we called the emergency shelter for women and children in town and got a woman counselor on the line, and they're in there talking right now. So you can't go in there. This was a man who is a social worker and had some training in this field and had the ability to see these things that I might not have seen and do something about it, to take action. Eventually, the woman on the phone made the decision to take her children and go to the shelter and not go back home. An enormous victory for her. And then my friend, the man who had initiated all this, turned to me and said, "Roger, now you need to go to her home and tell her husband she's not coming back." Well, actually, her husband was a very active member of the congregation. He had served on the board in the past. He wasn't on the board at that moment, but he had been on the board, and he was involved in the worship committee and involved in many of the activities of the church. I knew him quite well. So I went to his home, and I went inside, and we sat down, and I told him that his wife and his children were not coming home. And I told him that we had seen the bruises, that she had confirmed that he had been hitting her, and that she was not coming back. Well, he cried and told me that he was ashamed of what he had done, but then he told me all the things that she had done to cause him to do this, which led eventually to me saying, "There is no excuse. There is nothing you can tell me about her or about your background to justify what you have been doing. And I think you need to, quite frankly, look at a complete separation and a divorce. You should not be together. This relationship should be over." And he cried some more. I spent over an hour with him. And I learned that day that first lesson about, okay, being honest and direct, sometimes you can talk yourself out of a beating. I learned in the second lesson, get on a train and go outside of town and you'll calm down. Give it 20 minutes and things will be okay. That'll work sometimes. And I learned about breathing and calming down to be nonviolent. But I learned a fourth thing too. Sometimes you have to intervene and you have to separate. You have to get away from the person who is committing violence and find a safe place to be, and don't go back and be around that person who is violent. It is so critical sometimes to to leave the situation and get into a safe place and to get help in doing that. And that all of us have a role in trying to recognize when a situation is such that people need to be separated. That is also living nonviolence, separating people who are violent, and doing it in a firm, loving, but firm way. Former President Jimmy Carter has just published a book in which he argues that the most serious and unaddressed worldwide challenge is the violent abuse of women and girls. In the spring of 2001, a group of women in the Unitarian Universalist Congregation in Bethesda, Maryland, where I was serving, decided, this was nothing I initiated, this was completely done by them. They decided that they were so concerned with the treatment of women in Afghanistan, and this was before 9/11, they were so concerned by it that they felt that they needed to do something to address the problem. So they invited Afghanis who were living in exile in the Washington, D.C. area to come and talk with them about the problem and what could be done, which eventually led to the congregation holding a series of fundraisers to raise thousands of dollars to support a women's school in Afghanistan. So living everyday nonviolence isn't just living in our own world. It's also looking at the violence that's going on internationally and picking an issue of some kind and trying to help and do something about it. It was an incredible experience to see these women in my congregation take this action and to see them reach out to people who were stranger to them and try to do what they could. One of the speakers who came back in the summer of 2001 to the church to speak was a medical doctor, an eye doctor, who had joined the Northern Alliance, the opposition to the Taliban, and was visiting Washington. His name was Dr. Abdullah. And we listened to him talk about the situation there and what possible solutions there were. And he particularly, because it was a women's group, focused on the treatment by the Taliban of women and how tragic this was and how we needed to change that and create a more civilized country in Afghanistan where women were treated with respect and with decency and were allowed to have an education and could not be harmed in the way they were being harmed. And I thought about that this week in the last few days because Dr. Abdullah is now a candidate for president of Afghanistan. The election is next Saturday. He is the leading candidate according to the polls. However, this is the second time he's won, and the first time, because of voter fraud, he did not become president. Karzai was reelected. And there is a real possibility of voter fraud again. So it's very questionable whether or not he will be successful. But the women, the progressive women that I met who were from Afghanistan, have an enormous belief that this man, Dr. Abdullah, if he becomes elected, will lead Afghanistan into positive and affirming directions. But of course, it is a terrible situation over there, and we have sacrificed so much money and so many Americans. Let's hope that they're right about him and that he is elected. I think about the issue of everyday nonviolence, not only in our own relationships with each other, but also our relationship with the larger world. So what is everyday nonviolence? It's not a systematic answer I've given you this morning, not a comprehensive answer, just a few of my own experiences, just a few stories. The story of the man on the street who hit me. I learned there that through simple, short, honest I statements, I could reach the kinder side of a violent young man. I told the Woodrow Wilson story about the angry man who took the streetcar to the edge of the city. One researcher says, to avoid violence, take a 20-minute timeout. Third, I told the story of the Zen Buddhist priest who could control his anger by paying attention to his breathing. Meditative breathing can help us be calm when we feel under attack. Fourth, I told the story of an intervention. Sometimes I statements and timeouts and breathing are simply not enough. Everyday nonviolence sometimes requires getting away from a violent person, getting to a safe place. And others need to see the problem and be ready to help. And finally, I told the story of international intervention. If we are fortunate to live our lives here in Sarasota almost completely free of violence, we can contribute in our small ways to helping others around the world. This is also everyday nonviolence. We are potentially violent creatures, you and I. Under the right circumstances, I can physically harm others. I can do so to justify it by defending myself or my family, my friends, even defending my congregation. It is part of our biological inheritance. Nevertheless, I have faith that over the generations, our culture will change. I do not see a time without any violence, but I believe each generation can improve from the past, creating healthier human relationships, affirming the inherent worth and dignity of every person.